How are you?
Well, thank
Mike,
you.
How you doing?
I'm doing well, thanks.
Good.
Looking forward to seeing you on Friday.
Yep, should be fun. I'm going to bring my D-plus game. How about you?
I always bring my D-plus game.
Yeah. But you know, the good thing, it's supposed to be a nice day.
Yeah, I just saw Kelly's playing, too.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, it should be good. I'm thinking that last place is definitely probably in order.
I would hope.
we'll give it our best shot, won't we?
Yeah. Well, wasn't it last year that it was just ridiculous that we won it?
Yeah, it was something like, I don't know, 15 under or whatever like that.
Like a 56 or 57 total, yeah.
Yeah, something like that.
I think we just don't cheat enough. That's the whole key.
Listen, I'll have to talk offline to you about that. I can't talk about cheating.
Oh, no, of course not.
Right? At least officially.
Got it.
Yeah. How's Dave doing?
Okay. I told him we had a Eagle seminar on Friday. Oh, he's doing well. Everybody's
good.
Hey, are we riding together?
Yeah.
Good.
Yep.
I can get like 5 hours of free legal advice. That's perfect.
You know what they say about free legal advice?
Yeah, it's every penny.
How about them O's?
Oh, man.
Unbelievable, isn't it?
When is the other shoe going to fall?
Well, the way I see the problem is that none of their starters go past five innings. And sooner or later, it seems to me their bullpen just gets worn out.
That's a ball, though.
Yeah, well, that's true. He pitched, would he pitch into the seventh the last time he pitched?
7 1/3, I thought.
But he's the only one. I mean, everyone else has gone like five innings. You just can't continue, I think, to exist like that.
Good morning, Howard.
Hey, how are you?
Fine, thanks. It's Ann Welsh.
Ann, how are you?
I'm doing well, thanks, especially with this nice spring weather. Come back to visit.
you don't mind that we were talking about the Orioles, do you?
No, not at all. I had it on speaker because I thought you had already started, then I banged it on.
No. Hey, listen, no need to apologize. We're just, it's a beautiful day out there today, unlike the last probably 3 weeks.
Oh. And the Orioles are doing well. I don't really follow, but they seem to be doing well.
Yeah, they not only seem, they are.
Great.
They are. Unbelievable.
Great business for the city.
I was thinking
yes,
the same
is.
Thing.
Absolutely.
It's good business for the city. I agree with you.
Hi, Howard. It's Laurie. How are you?
Hey, Laurie. How are you?
Good.
How's
Laurie, it's Mike. How you doing?
Oh, good, Mike. How are you?
Good, thanks.
Hi, Howard. It's Carrie Lyons. How are you?
Good. How you doing?
I'm good, thank you.
Good. As I said, we all got to be good on a day like today when the sun's out. It's going to be nice for the next 7 days.
And the O's will be back playing, so that's good.
Yeah, Ann, how are you?
I'm well, thank you. Glad to have a chance to hop on.
I'm sure that when the Orioles are playing well, you sell more papers.
We absolutely do.
There you go.
Oh, yeah, it's good business all around.
Yeah.
It reminds people that there's a lot in this city that's really great.
Yeah, well, wasn't it yesterday was the year since the Freddie Gray thing?
No. Well, a year since his arrest.
Right.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. And we have the a year since his burial is coming up. the very end of April, like April 29, 30, May 1, that kind of thing. Maybe a little sooner than that.
Hopefully there won't be any disturbances.
No, I think there may be demonstrations. I don't think there's the feeling that there are going to be disturbances. The concern, at least here, is that disturbances will relate to the trials. And how trials go.
Yeah.
I keep thinking that those police officers probably can't work until they get through this whole trial.
Yeah, I think they're all on suspension.
I think they are, too. Some, I don't know if they're with pay or without. I don't remember anymore.
I'm not sure either. Actually, one of the law firms that's representing a couple of the officers is on the 8th floor of our building. I know that they've been pretty busy, that's for sure.
Yeah, the trials start up again pretty soon.
In May, yeah.
Mm-hmm. There will be, Howard, if you're not ready to begin yet, let me just advertise that, you know, it's the 100th anniversary of the Pulitzer Prizes, and to commemorate that, the Maryland Humanities Council and the Baltimore Sun have been doing a series of discussions here, free, open to the public, in our building with Pulitzer Prize winners and reporters from the Sun. And the next one coming up is next Tuesday, April 19th.
Who's going to be there?
Challenges Faced by Baltimore. So we've got in it Justin Fenton, who's our Courts and Crimes reporter. He's a reporter for The Sun. Erica Green, who's a Baltimore City Schools reporter here at The Sun. E.R. Shipp, who won the Pulitzer Prize in 1996 for commentary. He's an associate professor of at Morgan Global Journalism and Communication, and Diana Sugg, who is a Baltimore Sun Pulitzer Prize winner, and she's one of our editors for beat reporting and medical issues. So that is Tuesday, April 19th, 7 o'clock at the Sun, open to the public. The Pulitzer Prizes will also have been announced the day before. We're in hot contention for our coverage of all Freddie Gray issues. So
I'm gonna vote early and often for the Sun.
Yeah, there you go. It's just and then right. I'll make stuff. You get into your stuff now. The promo is over.
Well, that's okay. Thank you, Ann. That's great, and I appreciate you bringing everybody into the fold there. Hopefully, some people will attend. Okay, it's 9:03 by my clock. We are going to start. Michelle, can you put this on presentation mode, please?
Presentation mode is now disabled.
Okay. We are going to begin. This is the April the 13th telebrief. As you know, we do these the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month. So here we are. There's plenty to report today, as there always is. First of all, those of you who are out there following the goings-on in the Maryland legislature know that one of the big bills that unions and employees lobbied for was the Maryland Healthy Working Families Act, which would have mandated, of course, paid sick leave at different rates for employers in the state of Maryland. It got very close, it seems to me, to passing in one iteration or another. I think it got tied up with the governor's tax bill. And because neither one of them passed, this is probably going to resurface next year in the Maryland State Legislature, and it may very well pass. But it didn't pass in the 2016 legislature. More to come on that probably in 2017. However, I do want to report that on April the 5th, that's only, you know, a week ago, more or less, San Francisco became really the first United States city to mandate paid parental leave in order that parents can bond with their children. A fairly a sort of out there piece of legislation. I always tell clients who want to potentially locate businesses in California to think twice about it because of the difficulty with which employers have to face very pro-employee legislation and ordinances out in California. Anyway, what happens under this statute, just to give you some information, as to whether or not this will serve as a model for future legislation in East Coast cities, I don't know. But frequently that does happen, so let me just tell you a little bit about it. Already existing in California was a statutory scheme under which employees would get partially paid leave through the California Disability Insurance Program in order for them to be able to take parental leave, and that would be 55% of their pay, up to $1,129 per week. But under the ordinance passed by San Francisco Board of Supervisors, employers, as of January 1, 2017, who have 50 or more employees, have to make up the difference between what the employees would get under the California pay, the disability pay, and what their regular pay would be up to 6 weeks. In order to be eligible for this particular benefit, employees must have worked for their employer for 180 days before the leave period. Interestingly, this benefit will cover part-time employees as well as temporary employees, which I find to be pretty unusual. In most cases, as you probably know, temporary employees are not covered by statutes of this kind, but under the San Francisco ordinance, they are covered. This statute or ordinance has bite to it because those employers who do not comply with it are subject to a private right of action on behalf of the employee, which includes restitution, liquidated damages, and injunctive relief, and attorney's fees. The statute does allow an employer to apply 2 weeks of paid PTO to the 6 weeks of leave, but that it also says that if an employee is terminated while he's entitled to the 6 weeks of leave, he's still entitled to the 6 weeks of leave irrespective of the fact that he may have been terminated by the employer. So you can see it's a very, very pro-employee piece of legislation. And as I said, I don't know its reach beyond San Francisco, beyond California, but it's an indication of a trend that seems to be, I think, in vogue and probably on the march throughout the country, so stay in touch. In something that, turning the page to something that I think has probably even more practical import to those of you out there in the HR field, it's sort of a scary case coming out of the Second Circuit. The Second Circuit, as some of you know, covers the states of New York, Connecticut, and Vermont, but the Second Circuit is a very influential circuit when it comes to making law throughout the country. Next to the D.C. Circuit, probably the Second Circuit is the most influential that we have in the country. And in a very, very recent case called Kathleen Graziadio versus Culinary Institute of America, again coming out of the Second Circuit, the Second Circuit denied or reversed a grant of summary judgment to an employer, which is the Culinary Institute of America in this case. And what happened in this case is a former employee of the Culinary Institute sued the Culinary Institute for violating her rights under the FMLA and retaliating against her. The scary part about this suit was that not only did the ex-employee sue the Culinary Institute, but it also sued the HR director, with whom she had the most contact with her request for FMLA leave. She wanted FMLA leave to take care of two children that she had who were experiencing some medical problems. And what the Second Circuit dealt with was a situation in which there were numerous emails. The Second Circuit characterized them as almost egregious or excruciating between the HR director and the employee, going back and forth with regard to the employee's request for FMLA leave and what the HR director was insisting upon with regard to the employee. And ultimately, one of the questions that the Second Circuit faced was whether or not there would be individual liability on the part of the HR director in addition to potential liability on the part of the Culinary Institute of America. And ultimately, what the Second Circuit decided was that they would apply what's called an economic realities test to determine whether or not the HR director exercised in a regular way sufficient authority over FMLA matters to be deemed to be, in quotes, an employer, close quotes, under the FMLA. As you know, under the Fair Labor Standards Act, there can be individual liability on an officer or an executive of a company who is deemed to be an employer under the Act if, under this economic realities test, under the Fair Labor Standards Act, someone exercises enough control over the decision that a court could find that particular particular officer or executive to be equally responsible as the corporate entity for whom that particular person works. And this was a very what lawyers call a case of first impression with the Second Circuit adopting that economic realities test and deciding that for purposes of the Fair Labor Standards Act, somebody could be considered to be, in this case an HR director, could be considered to be an employer under the following four factors that were considered. So the following four factors that the court considered were, one, whether the person had the power to hire and fire the employee. And in this case, what the Second Circuit found was that the HR director's recommendation that the employee who was accused of abandoning her position when she did not supply sufficient information return to work information under the FMLA, that she could be considered to be the employer along with the Culinary Institute. So the first factor, whether the person had the power to hire and fire the employee, the Second Circuit found in favor of the fact that the HR director was, in fact, the employer in this case. Two, whether the person supervised and controlled the employee's work schedule or conditions of employment. Again, what the Second Circuit found was that by her interactions with the particular employee, that she had interjected herself so far into whether or not this person was coming back to work that, yes, indeed, the HR director controlled the conditions of employment of this particular employee. Three, whether the person determined the rate and method of payment. Here, the Second Circuit again found that the factors militated in favor of the HR director be considered to be the employer of the employee. And lastly, whether the person maintained employment records. Essentially, what the court found was that the overarching question of whether the HR director controlled the employee's rights under the FMLA was that there seemed to be ample evidence to support the conclusion that she did. And the Second Circuit cited the fact that the HR director reviewed the employee's FMLA paperwork, determined its adequacy, controlled the employee's ability to return to work and under what conditions, and sent the employee nearly every letter, including the termination letter, concerning her leave. Given this, the Second Circuit concluded that the HR director, in quotes, exercised sufficient control over Graziato's employment to be subject to liability under the FMLA. I think the case is instructive, and it's scary for those of you out there who have control over FMLA decisions, in the sense that depending upon what's done or what's not done with a particular employee, that employee may be able to sue or claim rights under the FMLA of retaliation or substantive rights, not only against the company, but against the HR director who was intimately involved in the decision. It does not mean that in every case, obviously, if you or someone that you know as an HR director or who is responsible for administering those benefits is going to be responsible. I think what it does do is militates greatly in favor of, if somebody's in charge of FMLA administration or FMLA decision making, that person needs to be well trained on substantive FMLA rights, on what needs to be done to administer the act, to administer the rights under the act, and to make sure that whoever is administering the FMLA on behalf of your company is well schooled in terms of how to handle certain things, and if he or she is really up to their neck or unsure of what to do in a particular situation, that employment counsel be consulted. The last thing that anybody wants to do is to be hit with personal liability with regard to FMLA decisions. It also militates, obviously, in favor of strong indemnification provisions or protection between the company and the HR director in any of these situations where FMLA rights are being determined or the FMLA administration is left up to a singular person or persons. So again, this is a Second Circuit decision. It doesn't necessarily bind the courts in other districts. For instance, Maryland is in the Fourth Circuit. We don't know how the Fourth Circuit would rule, but again, the Second Circuit is an influential circuit. So I bring this to your attention, and I indicate to you that we need to pay attention to this because it's kind of a scary decision. Talking about, EEOC and these FMLA things, I wanted to bring to your attention an interesting case. On March 22nd, just a couple weeks ago, the EEOC filed suit in the United States District Court for the Western District of Missouri against a company called Grisham Farm Products, Inc., alleging that its employment application violated the ADA and the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act, GINA, because according to the EEOC's complaint, the company violated both acts by requiring job applicants to fill out a 3-page health history before they would be considered for a particular job. In this case, the plaintiff had applied for a warehouse position, and the application contained 43 yes or no health-related questions related to whether the applicant had seen a physician for a variety of things in the past 10 years, including allergies, arthritis, bladder infections, eating disorders, gallstones, sexually transmitted diseases, etc. And the application's health history section stated in bold, large letters that, in quotes, all questions must be answered before we can process your application. Now, as you all know, or hopefully know, that under the ADA, you can conduct a health inquiry, but only under the situation where a conditional offer of employment has been made, and if the inquiries are made and they're related, job-related, and consistent with business necessity, and that all other applicants for the particular position are subjected to the same particular requirements. In this particular situation, I think it's an egregious case, and I don't know why this particular company, probably was not well advised by any competent employment counsel, would have such a detailed health application requirement But it did, and I have no doubt that either this case will be settled or the company will lose if it goes to trial. So the takeaway for you is, you know, make sure that if you're using health-related inquiries, that they come after a conditional offer of employment has been made and only in that particular situation. Another thing that has come to light, and I had this question come up from a client in the last few weeks, it pertains to video surveillance in the workplace. Some of you may use video surveillance. Video surveillance is certainly countenanced in various jurisdictions, including Maryland. However, if you use video surveillance, it needs to be done in an area where there would be no reasonable expectation of privacy on the part of an employee. So, for instance, you wouldn't have video surveillance set up in a men's room or a woman's restroom. And also, you would not have video surveillance that also has audio on it, because in Maryland, as you probably know, and in other jurisdictions, it's a two-party audio authorization, which means that you can't record employees unless both parties to the conversation are authorizing that particular recording. So I caution you that in video surveillance, you can do it, but you need to do it in an area where there's no expectation of privacy and there's no audio involved. Interestingly, in an article very recently, it was brought out that Amazon, and we all know who Amazon is, had video surveillance in its warehouses. And what they did was they caught certain employees who allegedly were guilty of theft. And what they did was they installed flat-screen TVs in their warehouse displaying the alleged offenders with the word, in quotes, terminated, close quotes, across blackened silhouettes, along with the details of what these employees stole and the value of what they stole. Now, I would caution you that employers can defame employees, not only but what they say about them verbally, but in many cases about what certain other displays may portray. So in this case, if Amazon is wrong or was wrong about the fact that somebody may have stolen something from their warehouse, simply by showing the particular silhouette of the employee or the picture of the employee on a flat screen TV with the word that is terminated, in quotes, across the screen would be very problematic from a defamatory standpoint if the information was incorrect. So you got to be careful about defamation in the workplace, but the main takeaway in this is whether or not you are recording things in a way that would defame employees or in an area where there would be a reasonable expectation of privacy. The last case that I wanted to mention is a case, very recent case decided last week by the Eighth Circuit in a case called Morris, M-O-R-R-I-S-S, versus BNSF Railway. And the main issue in the Eighth Circuit case was whether or not obesity in and of itself is considered to be a disability under the ADA. What the Eighth Circuit decided in this case was that obesity in and of itself, unrelated to a physiologic condition which emanates out of obesity, is not protected under either the ADA or the ADA Amendments Act. And in this case, you had an employee who applied for a warehouse job, which was a safety-sensitive position in the particular, a machinist job, which was a safety-sensitive job in this particular company. And his obesity was that he was like, I think, 5'10", weighed 270 pounds, and was over the body mass index permitted by the company, and the company's assumption was that if he weighed this much and was that much over the body mass index requirement, that he would be much more prone to disability issues in the workplace. Now, what the court was faced with was a situation where the employee denied that he had any health issues. His own expert denied that he had any health issues. So it wasn't a case where, for instance, he may have been diabetic, associated also with the obesity, or he may have had breathing or heart problems. in fact, his own evidence and the evidence of his own expert was that he did not have any particular health issues. And so the issue before the Eighth Circuit was, in conjunction with decisions that had already been decided in the Second Circuit and the Sixth Circuit, finding similarly that obesity in and of itself is not a disability, was the Eighth Circuit agreed and said that in this case, the company was within its rights to determine that they would not go forward with this person's application because of his alleged obesity and his excess weight in relation to the requirements of the company. So those of you who have obesity-related requirements know that at least under the state, under the feds, the federal requirements under the ADA, it's not a protected classification in and of itself. Most states, it's the same thing. But if it's physiologically related, that is, if there's a disability-related breathing issue or there's a disability-related diabetic issue, you may be into a different circumstance. So those are the developments of the day. Michelle, can you take it off of mute, please?
Presentation mode is now disabled.
Okay. So as we always do, I'll be happy to take any questions or comments. If those of you out there have any particular questions, you can call me at 410-209-6417 or my email, hkerman@offitkerman.com.
Yes, in that Second Circuit Court of Appeals case versus the Culinary Institute, what was the name of the employee? I didn't catch the citation.
Hold on one second.
I wrote down Graziano, but I know that's not correct.
No, it is. It's the, give me one second.
I mean, this is something we all ought to be really alert to.
I totally agree with you. Give me one second. It's Graziadio, not Graziano. It's Graziadio.
Right. And could you spell that, please?
Yep. It is Kathleen Graziadio, G-R-A-Z-I-A-D-I-O, Graziadio.
Thank you. And did you say that this economic realities test currently exists under the Fair Labor Standards Act?
It does.
So
if you ever are in a situation where a company is sued in an FLSA count, many times plaintiff's attorneys may in fact include the president of the company or vice president of the company who was intimately involved, for instance, in denying overtime to an individual. Because under economic realities, there are certain situations where an executive may be jointly and severally liable with the company for an FLSA violation.
Got it. Thank
you. Okay. Any other questions, comments out there? Okay. Well, if not, we will see each other on the 27th of April. I think that's the date. And until then, if you have any questions or comments, give me a call or send me an email, and we'll look forward to the next telebrief. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Thank you, Howard.
Bye, Howard.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Take care. Bye. Bye-bye.
Thanks.